एतानि विद्यमानानाम्
एतानि विद्यमानानाम्
कामकृतो भयम्
इच्छामकृतो भयम्
योगिनां योगिनां
योगिनां योगिनां
ladies. Okay, you doing word for word, Daly?
Yes.
Okay. Shruti Sagar? You're on a roll, so do the verse too. Say my voice more.
O King, constant chanting of the holy name of the Lord. On after the ways of the great authorities.
O King, constant chanting of the holy name of the Lord after the ways of the great authorities is the doubtless and fearless way of success for all, including those who are free from all material desires, those who are desirous of all material enjoyment, and also those who are self-satisfied by the dint of transcendental knowledge.
Okay. This is a rather long purport that has two sections to it. And one section we're not going to do today because we just did it. And that is a section on the 10 offenses in chanting of the holy name. And we just had an initiation ceremony. Many of you were there, and that was discussed. And also, if I speak about the 10 offenses, I start feeling so guilty. So anyway, so we can avoid that for the moment. This book first came out, the second canto, first came out in small little books. One was called The First Step in God Realization. The next one, I think, is Lord in the Heart, right? Right, Lord in the Heart. And it came out in a series of little books. And I remember when they first came out, it was so exciting to see them because we hadn't seen these verses before. So imagine seeing devotees seeing these verses. What these verses, we'd heard Prabhupada speak, he had his volumes, but you have your own copy and read this, The First Step in God Realization. What a name. Now, it's curious, when does a first step in God realization occur in this chapter? What event? It's ironical. It's an ironic event. It's the first step. Excuse me? I say it. Well, yeah, you might say so. It's really, the first step is occurring at the very end. Usually you think of first step at the beginning, but the first step is death. Right? It's at the very end. So here's the first step in God realization at the very end. So the lesson we have from this is eat, drink, and be merry. For tomorrow you may die. And then 7 days before you die, you can do the first step in God realization. So that's the lesson. So class is dismissed. And that lesson is taken by many. That lesson is taken, very seriously. Especially those from Indian background who are familiar from their young age with this, with these verses, and say to them, yes, and that is what I will do at the end of my life. After all, the first step in God realization was taken by Parikshit just before he was going to die. So, 7 days, 7 years, 7 months, I'll have some idea when I'm going to die, and then I'll take up this process. I can do the first step. Meanwhile, I got some real heavy Grihamedi things to do. And also, I'm really enjoying this world, and I know that's Maya. So I should get rid of this enjoying nature by getting rid of these things. These things are in me. I have a desire to, be a successful computer geek. All I wanted to do was be, like the king geek somewheres, or no offense. I want to be whatever else. I want to be the supreme physicist, or I want to be the supreme businessman, or I want to be this. I have these desires and whatever else there may be. So let me get rid of these so at the end of my life I can be peaceful and engaged in just chanting the holy name. Or whatever else I'm supposed to do, or doing rituals, or giving charity, or I'll do something to get in heaven. Don't worry about that. Look, I got such a good birth this time. I got nice human birth. I got nice parents. I got a good education. I'm very good looking. I'm handsome. I'm beautiful. I got good karma. Come on. I got it. I might as well, use this karma, and I'll be a little charitable too. I'm a nice guy. Not only do I have good karma, but I want everyone to know I have good karma, so I'm going to be charitable and give a little here and there and put my name up on the building so people know I have good karma. Because what good is having good karma if people don't appreciate it? And it's good for them, because they can know that if they behave well, next life they can maybe not be envious of me, and maybe even can be me, because I'll be so much better anyway. What the hell do I care? So anyway, this is thoughts like this. Why wait until the end? And the more I talk about it, the more I'm liking it. That's an interesting idea. Except there's a flaw. So we'll get into the purport and talk about some of the flaws. I mean, there's the obvious flaws and the subtle flaws. I am going to borrow a reader to read a paragraph for me. I'm just having some voice issues.
In the previous verse, the great necessity for attaining attachment to Mukunda has been accredited. There are different types of persons who desire to attain success in the different varieties of pursuits. Generally, the persons are materialists who desire to enjoy the fullest extent of material gratification. Next to them are the transcendentalists who have attained perfect knowledge about the nature of material enjoyment and thus are aloof from such an illusory way of life. More or less, they are satisfied in themselves by self-realization. Above them are the devotees of the Lord, who neither aspire to enjoy the material world nor desire to get out of it. They are after the satisfaction of the Lord Sri Krishna. In other words, the devotees of the Lord do not want anything on their personal account. If the Lord desires, the devotee can accept all sorts of material facilities, and if the Lord does not desire this, the devotee can leave aside all sorts of facilities, even up to the limit of salvation. Nor are they self-satisfied, because they want the satisfaction of the Lord only. In this way, Sri Sukadev Goswami recommends the transcendental chanting of the holy name of the Lord. By offenseless chanting and hearing of the holy name of the Lord, one becomes acquainted with the transcendental form of the Lord, and then with the attributes of the Lord, and then with the transcendental nature of his pastimes, etc. Here it is mentioned that one should constantly chant the holy name of the Lord after hearing it from authority. This means that hearing from the authorities is the first essential. Hearing of the holy name gradually promotes one to the stage of hearing about his form, about his attributes, his pastimes, and so on. And thus the necessities of the chanting of his glories develop successively. This process is recommended not only for the successful execution of devotional service, but also even for those who are materially attached. According to Sri Sukadev Goswami, this way of attaining success is an established fact, concluded not only by him but also by all other previous acharyas. Therefore, there is no need of further evidence. The process is recommended not only for the progressive student in different departments of ideological success, but also for those who are already successful in their achievement as fruitive workers, as philosophers, or as devotees of the Lord.
Oh, we stop there. Okay, there is a key word in here. And the key word in this paragraph defeats the argument I just gave. So, what is the key word in the paragraph? This is the mystery test. There was hearing. Well, how does that defeat what I just said? I just gave an argument. And it was a good argument. I'm starting to like it more and more as I think about it. What is the, there is a word in here. There is one word. Okay, I'm going to make it easier for you. We're going to go back because you can't see the whole thing. That's right. So let's scroll back to the sentence, the sentence, hearing of the holy name gradually promotes one. Let's go back to that sentence. Here it is. I scroll down a little more. Okay. Hearing of the holy name gradually promotes one to the stage of hearing about his form, about his attributes, etc., etc. What is the key word in there that defeats my argument? Gradually. In other words, if you wait until the end for 7 days, I mean, Pariksha was a, you know, great devotee to begin with. Now, how many times has Prabhupada said in the Veda base, in his words, that Krishna consciousness is a gradual process? Let's have a little guessing game here, and the winner gets to win. Okay. 1,008. No. More guesses. 10,000. Okay. 400. 600. 200. That's getting warm. 150. Actually, I lost count after that, and maybe a few more. Yeah. When Prabhupada says something 150 times, he probably means it. I mean, if I say something 150 times to you, I say, will you get this right? You know? I mean, will you, 150 times, it means something. You know, if you say something once, it may have some great importance, but 150 times. It is the style of the Vedas to repeat very important points. We find entire verses in the Gita are repeated. Entire verses. And so something important is repeated. Now, we know, we find this now on a certain street in New York. What street in New York has learned the art of repetition? There's a street in New York that has a profession, and this profession is headquartered on a particular street in New York City, and they have learned the art of repetition. Broadway? No. What's Madison Avenue? Madison Avenue is where all the advertising agencies are. And what do the advertising agencies do? They repeat everything over and over and over again. They'll put it in billboards. They'll put it in magazines. They'll put it on the radio. They'll put it on TV. Everywhere's repeating the message. If you hear it long enough, you get brainwashed about it. So we have the same thing. Prabhupada says something 150 times. He's trying to brainwash you. By brainwashing, in this case, we mean opening up, taking a scrub brush, scrubbing out all the dirt, and that's brainwashing also. So brainwashing can be adding dirt or taking away dirt. So this is 150 times. So it's gradual. So gradual means, I give an example. How many of you have a degree or are in a program to get a degree? Okay. Okay. And now, those of you in that program, I can give an argument. You really don't need to bother. I mean, because take Bill Gates. Everyone knows who Bill Gates is. He dropped out of Harvard University. You all probably know that story. He was a Harvard dropout. And then he, went to, this is actually a very good lesson. He was at the University of, I think it was Seattle. And at that time, you didn't have computers on your desk. There was a big mainframe computer. And it was called time sharing. And you get so much time on it. And that time you would even have to put in your information by punching cards. Didn't have terminals. So you have to punch cards that have little holes in it on the keyboard, and you put it in and do your programming, and it comes out. And then the terminals came out after that. And some people, you may find it hard to believe, but at one time the Internet didn't exist. sorry about that. You know, hard to believe, isn't it? So it was very hard to get time on a computer. You had to book it. And this university got a brand new computer. You know the story about Bill Gates? Anybody know this? So it got a brand new computer. And Bill Gates somehow was working there or associated with it in some way. And it turns out that the computer was free all night, because it was new and hadn't been fully booked. During the day it was booked, but all night. Now, it was very rare in those days to have a whole mainframe computer. And we're talking about a computer that's less powerful than my cell phone that takes up this whole room. Okay? But that was it. So he had this computer, and all night it was free. And that was unheard of in America. You didn't get a computer free all night. But it had just been installed. It was a summer break, and the professors weren't using it all the time and weren't that many classes, so he had it all night, and he stayed up all night, every night, working on it. And then when the school year began, he squeezed in all the time he could. He wasn't a student, I forgot his relationship, and he got about 10,000 hours of programming time in. That's a lot. Turns out 10,000 is a magic number, somehow. Some studies have been done, and if you really want to become expert at something, 10,000 seems to be a number that works. Like, for example, if you really want to be a concert violinist or a concert cellist like Arjay Sita, it takes about 10,000 hours of practice. That's a common number. Now, it's not a hard and fast rule. It's not Shastric, but it turns out to work. And if you want to become expert at something, that's what it takes. You really want to be a super good Krishna cook. After about 10,000 hours, you're going to get really good at it. Takes that much time to often become an expert in the field. Bill Gates had 10,000 hours himself. Very few people in America had 10,000 hours. So what happens? IBM says, we need a program to run our new desktop computer. Bill Gates had the opportunity, well, I think I can write one for you. Because he had 10,000 hours, no one did. And he wrote it. And that became Microsoft. So that's how it began. Now, what's the relevance of that to us, especially the relevance of you that use a Macintosh computer? Completely irrelevant. But the point is that Bill Gates spent 10,000 hours. It's not that one day he came up with this brilliant program and sold it to IBM. He worked at it for 10,000 hours. And because of that 10,000 hours, he became expert. So similarly, if at the time of death we want to become expert, that's what's needed. Now, Bill Gates also didn't have a degree, but he has more degrees than everyone in this room combined. Who here has completed their degree? Let me see. Okay, so we got one. How many? Two. Roshana, you have one, I know. You three. So we got 3, 4, 5 degrees. So Bill Gates probably has 1,000 degrees. Honorary degrees. He has honor, but they count. You refer to him as Dr. Gates. You know, I call him Bill when I see him. But anyway, you refer to him as Dr. Gates. But he has a degree. So all of you can go for the honorary degree. You don't need to go to school. You can drop out and join a cult if you like. But I mean, you can tell your parents, I'm going to get an honorary degree. You can do that too. But you might not get one. Just might not get one. So similarly, you may need to put 10,000 hours into practicing devotional service to really get the hang of it. And that's why you can't wait to the last week. And, so the key word in this verse was, what was the key word?
Gradual.
It's a gradual process. Now, that gradual process is very important in our own lives because anybody here been on a roller coaster? Who's been on a roller coaster? Anybody not know what a roller coaster is? I'll describe. You have been in India, don't you? A roller coaster. You've been on one? They're fun, aren't they? They're about a blast. Anyway, our Krishna consciousness, we will find, will be somewhat of a roller coaster. It will have its ups and downs. It certainly will. If it only had its ups, then we're not... It's like going to a gym and lifting air. If it only has its ups, it doesn't go much. So there's constant challenges. So last night, I had to give a little... Who was there last night at the program? Okay, I had to give a little introduction for Radhana Swami. So how do you introduce somebody who's done so much, who's so, just so wonderful in all regards? How do you do it? I mean, I was like, I had a whole thing written out, I didn't know what to do. I was getting kind of nervous about it. What the heck am I going to do? And then I ran into Ambarish. Now, Ambarish gets to introduce a lot of people a lot of times. Wherever he goes, especially in India, it's very famous. Just being a Ford is a big deal. So he gets to get on the stage with very big people and introduce very big people. Ambarish, what am I going to do? He says, I always prepare a speech. I always throw it out. I always get very nervous. And then I always pray and it works out okay. That was his advice to me. I don't know if it worked out okay, but I followed his advice very strictly. Wrote a speech, threw it out, and just prayed, oh, Krishna, what can I say about somebody like Radhana Swami? So, and then I had to think of a joke, too. You always have to start off getting the audience loosened up. But I don't know if the joke went over. It was, Radhana Swami is an adventure of a funny thing happened on the way to the Ganges. Now, see, that's an expression in America. Because there was a play in 1960s called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum about Rome. It was a play. And then that saying came into the American lexicon. But I don't know how well it translates out there. But that is what happened. So, we dealt with the issue of gradual, and we dealt with the issue of why he's here. Now we're getting into the key element on this verse. And the key element on this verse, this is a very curious verse, because we're saying constant chanting after the ways of the great authorities is a way of success, including what categories? Those who are free from all material desires, who are desirous of material enjoyment, and those who are completely self-satisfied by having transcendental knowledge. Now, who in this room falls into one of those three categories? Anybody here meet one of those three categories of being completely transcendental, having all material desires, or free from all desires? Is there anybody here that can say at least one of those categories applies to me? Anybody? Anybody that those categories don't apply to? Maybe. Could be. So, those are the three categories of people. Usually, we say something, when we say something is a gradual process, you go from point A to point B. Now we're dealing with a little bit of odd math here. Because if you're at point B, or you're at point A, or you're in the middle, we're saying there's no real difference. Now, why is that? Why is it that a transcendentalist and a person who's desiring all material desires? Yeah, what's that? End is a means. What verse in Bhagavad Gita kind of talks about this a little bit? Okay, that's one verse. Any other verses? What verse kind of discusses this? I'll give one that helps. Or the other verse, what four categories of people approach Krishna? Okay, well, what are the four?
And
the one who's wise. No, it's all these four people. It's the same process. Now, this creates a dilemma for us. This is a real dilemma. And those who heard Radhana Swami's lecture last night heard him talk about this dilemma. This is a very serious dilemma. Very hard. Probably one of the hardest things you're going to do in Krishna consciousness. And it's a real dilemma. We have all kinds of people. So we have some people who are very, very advanced. Really relish the holy name. Very renounced. And then we have some people who are not very advanced. Maybe. And some people who are in the middle. And for all of them who have taken up the process of chanting the holy name, they're all to be recognized in a similar way. Now, of course, those who are more advanced to us, what do? We offer respect to. Those who are equals, we become friendship, and those who are less on the process, we try to mentor them. And of course, some of us might think, well, actually, I should be mentoring everybody. And then somebody else is thinking improperly, well, actually, everyone should be mentoring me. One devotee went up to Prabhupada one time, you've heard this, I'm sure, said, Prabhupada, I am the most fallen. And Prabhupada said to him, you know what? You're not the most anything. You're not the most anything. So it's very easy to get become overly humble. I cannot teach anybody anything. What do I know? Or to become overly proud. I can teach everybody everything. But to realize what our own position is, where we are on this spectrum, to be self-aware of that. And a few verses later on, a beautiful verse later on discusses this. well, it's a little later on in the chapter. We won't go there now. Yet, here is the hard challenge. Nobody quite knows where anybody else is. You know your own heart. You know the knower of your own body. But I don't quite know where any of you are at spiritually. I really don't. You don't know where I'm at. I mean, I have external symptoms. And you kind of, I speak and you either trust me or don't. But in my heart, I have to struggle with my mind, just as everyone else does. I have to struggle, you have to struggle. So we have symptoms. There's people that have symptoms. Like, for example, you have your professors. You know they know more than you do. You're going to take instruction from them. But how much do they know, and where are they at? Your spiritual master, you've studied. You said, look, this person I trust will connect me with the Parampara, so I'm going to give him my heart. Of course you do that. Yet we don't really know where each other's at spiritually, and we're all following the same process, though. So it's a hidden agenda in this verse, which comes out dramatically in the purport, has to do with sama darshana, equal vision. Anybody who has taken up the process of the holy name, we're not quite sure if they're struggling to get free from their material desires or they're actually free from them already. We don't really know. And we're not going to judge them very well because they're on the right process. And how does that come out? That comes out in the 10 offenses. Because in the 10 offenses, one of the key elements that makes life difficult, makes people not get along, creates conflict and quarrel and makes Kali Yuga into the Kali Yuga, is the fact that we tend to kind of judge each other. You're not very good because you did this. You're not very good because you did that. Which means I am very good because I know that you're not very good. So how, in other words, if I say, you're not very good at something, that means that I must be very good. Otherwise, how will I know you're not good? So I'm very good because I know you're not good. As soon as we get overly judgmental, the danger is that we then become very proud. And this verse is a message not for pride, because it says the great transcendentalist and the person who's struggling with all their desires is doing the same thing. We're doing the same thing. So it's a real lesson to not judge each other. Now that doesn't mean for the sake of management, sometimes judgment's not there. A manager must come and say, I'm training you, but you're chanting your japa, but you're actually chanting, Hare Krishna, Hare Shiva. And, Shiva's nice. We have great respect. He's good at drinking oceans of poisons. He's the greatest devotee of Krishna. But the Parampara doesn't recommend that. Of course, we have to instruct people. But that's instructing people in giving them some advice. We're not judging them. We're not saying, you are not a good person because you did this, or that. We are rather saying, there's something you're doing that I have some experience on, I can help you with. That is a big difference. So anyone who takes up to the holy name goes into the category of very saintly situated. Now Krishna says in the Gita, even further, he goes, apichet sudacharo. What does that verse mean? Person. Is that verse bewildering to you? Say it in the microphone. This is Gita 9:30.
Even if one commits the most abominable activity, if he is fixed in his determination in devotional service, he is considered to be saintly. Because he sent a proper path.
This verse is very bewildering to me. I read the Gita before I was a devotee. Read this verse. And it's the only verse I never knew Sanskrit or anything. I just read it in English. Franklin Edgerton's version and Radhakrishna's version of the Gita I'd read before I met the devotees. And when I read that verse, that was the only verse that stuck out in my mind. I said, it's paradoxical. It's contradictory. It doesn't make sense. So I asked my professor, I was undergraduate, Professor Kohler, can you explain this verse? And he answered, his very sophisticated, he's a Buddhist guy, very Buddhist, Zen type way of saying he doesn't know. And that was, it's intuitively obvious what it means, which is his way of saying, I have no idea. That's a very Zen way of saying it. It would have been nicer if he just said, I have no idea. So, fast forward a few years, I'm in India, I'm sitting with Prabhupada, I wasn't, you know, a devotee, I was just a high school teacher in India. I'm sitting with Prabhupada, and Prabhupada quotes a verse to me in Sanskrit. Now, I didn't know any Sanskrit, nothing at all. If you hear me pronounce it, you'll think the same now. So, didn't know any, and Prabhupada quotes the verse to me. Prabhupada knew I didn't know Sanskrit, quotes the verse to me, and says, so you know what this means. Wow, that was the only verse I knew in Gita in English. The first verse he quoted to me. It took me a little while later, it hit me. Wow, that was mystical. That was mystical indeed. The very first verse he quotes to me, then he says, you know this. And it was a verse I knew. I mean, I didn't know the exact translation, but it was a verse that had bewildered me 2 or 3 years earlier in college. Just a little bit. He quoted in Sanskrit, not English. But I knew it was that same verse that had mystified me. No, I didn't memorize it. I just knew it was that verse. I couldn't even say what the exact thing was in English. It was that same 9:30 that had bewildered me. And as soon as he quoted it, I realized, my God. He goes, do you know that? Or something like that. And I said, I do. And that was the same verse he had quoted to me. So that verse I'd meditate on a lot. It's kind of bewildering. How can you commit something abominable and be a saint? I mean, it's a very bewildering verse. And that verse, by the way, is often misused. Let me give you a little instruction on how to use that verse. Here's how we use that verse. That verse can only be used in certain tenses of speech, parts of speech. It can be used to describe you, and you. It can never be used to describe who? Myself! You can never use that verse for yourself. That's how that verse is often misquoted by devotees. Then you're guilty of committing the 7th offense in chanting of the holy name. So that verse is one that person really did something abominable, but he somehow, you know, chanting Hare Krishna, you know. Sometimes somebody does something so abominable. We had one case recently where somebody did something so abominable that it'd be banned from New Ramanreti. You know, put the whole place in legal jeopardy. Something so abominable. I'm not going to go into any of that. But he did something very abominable and it puts the place in legal jeopardy. So he's not allowed to go. But I'm meeting with him, encouraging him to chant the holy name and, you know, do something to seek rectification. So it doesn't mean that somebody walks in here with a McDonald's and we're chanting Hare Krishna and we say, okay, sit down and eat breakfast with us. It requires some discretion, some intelligence, but it does mean that we have to be very careful of who we judge. This is called the Sama Darshana Vision. And so this verse is giving us another angle on the Sama Darshana Vision. So we'll stop here for questions because I went 5 minutes longer than I intended to. Any questions, answers, comments, disagreements? Yeah, Varshana?
Well, I just have a common tendency it's such a common tendency because sometimes we don't even understand the context in which somebody's doing something. And we may just see, I mean, because I've been reading about that story, where was I reading that? About that sage or something who told the truth and went to hell. And then there was someone else
who
lied and he went to heaven because I was reading Acharya Dev's article on, so there are people that I'm forgetting there's the two terms. One is a sort of a results-based actions, and other people who are just sort of moralist kind of actions, but they sort of lose track of what the goal is. What's the result of this behavior? So the sage who lied, he's lied because he saved these people's lives. There was this, these robbers who were chasing a family.
And the sage told the truth and got them killed, and which was sinful. Yeah. It's a our ego is such that we always like expressing our ego, so we tend to judge, and sometimes we have to make distinctions. See, the difference is between judging and making distinctions. A sign of intelligence is to make distinctions. I make distinctions of who I associate with. For example, I'm here associating with you because I really like associating with the people here. It doesn't mean everyone who wears a dhoti I like associating with. I don't. So I might respect some people at a distance, some people at a very big distance. That's discrimination is who is associated with. It doesn't mean I'm condemning that person, myself as superior, or myself as, frankly, horribly inferior either. You know, I'm not the most fallen. I'm not the most anything. Sometimes we kind of have this language we use, this hyperbole type language. I'm the most this, I'm the humblest, I'm this and this and that. But, you know, who really believes I'm really the humblest? Come on, give me a break. You know, we try. You know, we try. It's a process. It is a what kind of process? Gradual process. So sometimes up, sometimes down. So when I'm having my down, I'm praying to gear Krishna, this is my down. I hope somebody up close with is having their up so they can help me. And I pray that when I'm in in a very clear-headed situated, boy, if Krishna gives me an opportunity to help someone who's down, that's mercy. You know, it's a play it forward kind of situation. Okay? Yes, Prabhu. Yeah. Oh, it's a good excuse. But it's an excuse, but a good one. It's like, let's say I'm a baby learning how to walk. So I'm going to fall down on my many times. And if I say, well, it's really just a process and I really don't have to try to walk, I'll be 6 years old and I'll still be falling down. At some point, we have to work on it to make it work. So if we just say it's a process, there's truth to that. It's a gradual process, but if we use that as an excuse, we'll never put in the work necessary. Let's say I have a job at a company. And I say, well, sometimes I don't do good work. Sure. But I'll be a long time before I get promoted. It's a process, and the boss is very liberal. And the boss says, look, I realize you won't get everything right, but, you know, do what you can. And so I do what I can and take a long coffee break and go home early. I'm doing the work. I'm not getting fired. I'm not getting promoted either. So if you work harder at the process, you get more results. At the same time, if every time I have a slip-up, you know, they have a beautiful, beautiful saying at the Japa school, the Japa retreat. It's beautiful. Because in chanting Hare Krishna on the beads, there's two problems that often arise. One is, I'm thinking, what a rotten mantra I just chanted. Didn't even listen. And the second thing is, how am I going to get the next one right? Those are the two. Anybody have those thoughts? Right? And those are the two most self-defeating thoughts you can have. Because while you're having either one of those thoughts, you're not thinking of that mantra. So it's kind of like a vicious cycle. So the secret of japa, Burajan puts this out brilliantly in his book, is what? Say again, loudly. Or one mantra at a time. The only mantra you're chanting is the one you're chanting. The one you did is gone. You can never bring that back. You can lament all day and night. That mantra, bye-bye. And the next one hasn't happened. But we tend to think, oh, what a rotten next mantra. I'm going to get the next one right. And we just blew that one while thinking of the next one because I was thinking of the last one. So it says one mantra at a time. I'm here, present now. Higher focus consciousness. Be here now. Mindfulness. All these terms are saying the same thing. And later on, it talks about this in this chapter. Focus consciousness. So we're focusing now. So if you're having, the key is to focus on this particular moment right now. What am I going to do at this moment right now? And you'll be very Krishna conscious at that moment. And those moments gradually turn into minutes, and the minutes turn into hours. And you realize, boy, I've become kind of somewhat expert. I really start seeing Krishna in places I didn't see Krishna before. And who is Krishna? He's all attractive. So Krishna will capture your heart that way. Okay. So, any other questions? Yes, Prabhu. You first. Here. Okay.
When I first read that verse too, I was confused with it. But then when I read the purport, Prabhupada, this is my understanding, is, you know, he mentions two times occasional fall down, and then like five other times accidental. So
correct.
It's like seven times in this one purport.
Correct.
It's like a accidental. It's like, you know, he says, you know, he said that statement, and then on the other hand, one should not understand that a devotee is transcendental devotional service can act in all kinds of abominable ways. This verse only refers to an accident due to the strong power of material, you know, connection. So it seems like he's saying, you know, that, you know, you may be in devotional service. You may be. It seems like he's saying if you, you know, you're engaged in, you know, devotional service because it's like a war against Maya. Things are going to come up. And you're going to maybe have some accidental fall down, but as long as you continue to chant, you'll be quickly relieved of, you know, having the desire to want to do this, or you'll be strong enough to stand against Maya.
Maybe not quickly, gradually, but yeah.
Or, you know,
yeah,
you
gradually.
Know, so by doing
and sometimes quickly. I mean, sometimes somebody gets enlightenment in just a moment. You know, things happen like that. Bill Gates got his honorary degrees, multiple ones, still didn't graduate Harvard. And Harvard will take him back. They'll take him back. Matarej is one of our God brothers, a very dear fellow. And he was in Harvard and dropped out to join the movement. And then he really done a lot of editing for BTG, a lot of writing, but he really needed a degree for various reasons. And I said to him, why don't you call Harvard up? And he says, it's 30 years ago. They're not going to take me back.
Who is this?
Matarej, really nice devotee. Matarej, come sometimes. Prabhupada disciple. I said, why don't you call Harvard up? He says, 30 years later, they don't want me back. I mean, you got to apply, it's hard to get in. I said, call them up. He calls them up. On the phone, they look up his record and say, would you like to come back? You're welcome back. You can go back to Harvard. And he started and finished. Why? Because Harvard has a plan that when they take someone, they want 100% graduation rate. That's Harvard's plan. So as hard as it is to get into Harvard, and it is very hard, once you're in, 30 years later, you want to come back, they'll take you back. Krishna's like that. You go to Krishna, you reach out to Krishna, and You disappear and become most abominable, but 30 years later, you want to reach out to Krishna, you're still admitted. It's that powerful. It's more powerful than Harvard University. So you can reach out. So you can commit many abominable activities. You can commit even worse offenses against devotees. you can drift away. But Krishna has reached out to your heart. So at some point you're back in. Now, this creates an interesting dilemma. Well, let me see. Krishna, I reached out to Krishna, I chanted Hare Krishna, maybe I took initiation, I'm here, everything's fine. You know, why don't I just go enjoy for a while? I got a free ticket back. The verse doesn't apply to that. That's not very accidental. That's the seventh offense in chanting the holy name. You may get back, but that's going to be a roller coaster that does loop-de-loop-de-loop and goes under the water too. It's not going to be the roller coaster I want to go on. But it's possible. It's possible. That verse can easily be misused. Remember, that verse always applies to others, never applies to ourselves.
This is the last sentence that Gopal was saying. If he does not improve in his character by devotional service, then it is to be understood that he is not a high devotee.
Yeah. He's not a high devotee. So if you're not a high devotee, then you better engage in a gradual process to get one. You know, if you want to do it. We have free will. Because there's no love without free will. So we certainly do have existential free will. Otherwise, there's no such thing, a thing as love. So we have to have that choice. We have to, like it or not. I mean, sometimes people say, well, you know, they used to do this thing. Anybody know what a lobotomy is? A lobotomy? Yeah, lobotomy, they used to do this operation up through the 1950s. If somebody had a mental illness, what they'd do is they would cut open their head or stick a tube up their nose and carve out the frontal lobe of the brain. And when you carve out the frontal lobe, let's say you have some bad mental disease of some kind, you carve out the frontal lobe of the brain, you can talk normally, you're intelligent in certain regards, but your whole emotional part of your brain is just gone. So you can't misbehave. You also can't do a lot of things. And you can't have affection either. It just, you know, just cut off that part of it. Now, of course, the soul always has affection, so it's possible for even people who are born with just little brain stems, sometimes they actually experience intelligence as a whole thing. The intelligence is not necessarily, is not part of the brain, yet the intelligence is manifested through the brain. And when we grow up and we become very attached to our body and our brain, if a piece of our brain's lost, we might lose that function. Even though the function, in one sense, is transcendental to a particular brain, it's manifested through there, and we're quite attached to that body at that time. So, somebody with a lobotomy, they actually will. A lot of studies been done, but they lose certain freedoms they had. They lose certain freedoms. We don't want to be lobotomized people.